Hello, everyone. It's 3:30. May I make your way to your seats, please? All right, we go on with papers this afternoon. Can I have your attention? Thank you. Any housekeeping? No. Yes, Maria, coming.
Sorry.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
People who have got the Braille key rings, please bring them for tomorrow's session with Ivan, please. Everyone should have got a Braille key ring, and he's asked that people bring it to the session tomorrow morning. Thank you.
I don't know what that means, but okay. Also, someone found an Auckland bus card on the floor. It's up here at my table if it's yours. Well, it's still up here at my table even if it's not yours. You know. Okay. So, would Wendy Richards and Neil Jarvis make your way up here, please? You are here. All right, we will give it to you. Thank you.
So, hello again, everyone. My name is Wendy Richards, and you, if you were here yesterday, saw my beautiful wee children, not so wee anymore, I like to claim them all as mine, performing yesterday. I teach Braille music at BLENZ, Blind and Low Vision Education Network New Zealand. I've been doing that for almost 25 years now. In my role there, I work with learners both one-to-one. I coordinate the weekend program, which was the students you saw yesterday. We also run live-in immersion courses, so those will change depending on the needs of the students each year. But that's like a live-in for a week, very intensive program. And more recently, I've been involved with coordinating and working with the team who run the Braille Music Retreat for adults every 2 years. So throughout my teaching, throughout the teaching over these last sort of 25 years, Lizette Wesling, who we are here to speak to you about the Wesling Awards, Lizette was the person I would turn to for advice. She became a very, very close friend of mine. And, you know, if I was stuck, it was always Lizette I would ring. So then I went on to do a bit of research around Braille music pedagogy, and following that had a really interesting conversation with Neil around how we could celebrate Lizette's life, honour her input, but also meet a real need, a key need that we had here in New Zealand. So I am going to hand to Neil now, who's going to tell you a little bit more about that.
I knew that would happen. Good afternoon, everybody. So I'm Neil Jarvis, and I was saying to Wendy before we started, I don't know why, but I'm really nervous about this presentation today, and I'm so used to doing presentations, but I think it's because it's something which is even closer to my heart than even most of the things that I do. So forgive me anyway. So, as Wendy says, we had a conversation on the phone about how we could first, in one way, honour Lizette's memory, and I'll be talking a little bit about that, and then also to meet this need that she had identified and that made perfect sense to me, knowing what I did from what Lizette always told me. So, by way of being open and transparent, Wendy is obviously a considerable subject matter expert in the field of music and in the field of Braille music. I am not. My reason for being here is obviously a great commitment to Braille and Braille music, but I was Lizette's husband, and so I have a different perspective, but one which means that we bring to this conversation the story of an unmet need and honouring someone who meant so much to both of us. So in this presentation, we're going to talk about the award. We're going to talk a little bit about Lizette, just to, so that people who may not know who she was, which seems impossible to me, but I'm sure there must be some people, why we created the awards and what the structure of them is, how they'll be assessed, and finally, what we think is the things that make it make these awards unique and make them stand out. So for a musician who is blind, achieving musical independence, autonomy, and equity often requires incorporating Braille music into one's broad repertoire of skills. We have created the Wessling Awards to represent a formal platform through which we celebrate Braille music, through which we encourage the active pursuit of Braille music skills and acknowledge the individual effort required to achieve this element of musical literacy. It's hard work, folks. And the focus is constantly on encouraging active engagement and practical music making through Braille. So who was Lizette? Lizette Wessling is the person in whose memory we have crafted these awards. And thinking about what she would have wanted and what she would think has been central to all our thinking and planning over the last few years. Lizette was born blind in the Netherlands, and she emigrated to New Zealand with her family when she was 8 years old. She studied and worked in New Zealand, Australia, and the UK, and it was in the UK where she ran into me, almost literally. We emigrated back to New Zealand, in her case, and for me for the first time, and indeed the last, in 2004, so 20 years ago. Lizette built a successful career through her position as on the stage as a performer and as a singer and as a teacher of music, both to blind and sighted students. She was also passionate about Braille. Braille was what she cared so, so much about. And since that and music were her two professional passions, she thought it would make most sense to combine the both of them into a book that she published in 2004 called Focus on Braille Music. Some of you in this room will have met Lizette, will have known her well. Some of you will not. But those of you who did, I'm sure, would agree that she had a big impact. She certainly had a big impact on the teaching of Braille music in New Zealand in the last 20 years, and Wendy will attest to that. She taught singing as well as performed. She believed that that singing and Braille were both things that provided people with a talent and with a skill that they could use to further their interests as well as their careers. Lizette firmly believed that, and this is something that she said in her book, just as language literacy can stimulate the imagination, music literacy can only enhance and strengthen a child's musical creativity. And she believed that all the way through her life. So that's who she was, and that's who we're wanting to honour. She died in 2016, only at the age of 44. It's hard to imagine that she packed so much into such a short life, but she did. I wanted to honour her in an appropriate way, and spent some time wondering how that could be. I set up a fund in her memory and in her honour. And when Wendy and I got to talking about ways in which we could both meet the objective of honouring Lizette, the Wessling Awards were born. So what are they? Well, as you all know, Louis Braille's tactile system of reading and writing music was published in 1829, and it's been in existence longer than many of the well-known international music examination systems. In New Zealand, we have a plethora of music examinations already available, including Trinity College, Royal School of Music, St. Cecilia, the New Zealand Music Examination Board, and the NZQA, the New Zealand Qualifications Authority School system. These examining bodies play a key and valuable role in music education. However, they are all performance or music theory print-focused systems. They do not assess musical and skills embedded within our Braille music learning culture. This includes the different cognitive processes required by a Braille music user to, for example, interpret rhythmic concepts and chordal structures, the ability to determine melodic shape from a horizontal line of notation, or the necessity to translate Braille symbols from a language perspective into music concepts. Wessling Awards are Braille-focused awards. Rather than replicating existing music theory or performance exams, Wessling Awards celebrate features of musicianship specifically to for the purpose of practical music making with Braille. They are designed to recognize established Braille music knowledge and encourage further learning in this important area of music literacy. Really important to stress, and we'll come back to this later, they are seen as complementary to other exams and other awards and that are and qualifications that exist. We are in competition with nobody. Wendy's going to talk about the structure of the awards and how assessments will be carried out.
Sorry. So as Neil mentioned, the Wessling Awards have got a really strong focus on encouraging the active use of Braille music. So we're really interested in the practical application rather than sort of building theoretical knowledge. And that concept, or that belief, if you like, is what has been the guide for the team that worked on this, because it was quite a big team, in terms of the content and how we would assess the awards. So Wessling Awards contain 5 levels of Braille music proficiency. Levels 1, 2, and 3 acknowledge the skills and the understandings that a Braille reader would need to be able to actively use to read it, to learn it, to be able to perform from a Braille score. So at level 1, it's that very basic music knowledge and very elementary music skills. As Neil said, we're not there to examine how well you perform, it's how well you can use that knowledge. So over levels 2 and 3, those elementary skills, that fundamental information, gets extended to the point where by level 3, we feel you would have the knowledge and the skills necessary for confident and competent musicianship. For a lot of people, that's all they're ever going to need. That's going to amply meet their needs, whether it may be at school and they've got, or they want to join the local choir, or they're in an ensemble group. That will be what they need. But levels 4 and 5 are there. They for those who do want to extend their skills further. So they incorporate the Braille music knowledge and the skills that would be vital for advanced music study. So those students who are going to perform at a very high level, perhaps they're going to pursue music studies beyond school. maybe for someone who wants to move into that transcription or music proofreading space, or who want to go forward and teach and be able to use that knowledge to support others. So because the key focus is around that practical application of knowledge, level five, for example, doesn't, even though it's the top of the ladder, doesn't demand that you memorise an extensive list of symbols. Because I think if we had mentioned today, there is so many symbols out there, and a lot of them are, particularly in music, are used in very specific contexts. Sometimes I even get the odd ones come through the school system where the students are examining a score and I'm like, well, I don't know. So it's about knowing, having the confidence, the competence, the understanding to go, well, I think it might be applying in this way, but knowing where to go and get that information so that you can reaffirm or confirm what you think that might be about, and then being able to communicate that in a way that's meaningful. So to gain a Wesling Award at any level, candidates will go through a series of tasks, and the tasks are there designed to assess Braille music-related skills. You have to meet the standard in all of the tasks. So at level one, there are only two. There's several examples within each of those, but there are only two. I know myself many years ago doing, I won't mention the examining body, but doing an exam as a child, being able to perform really well in some areas of that exam, and actually it was sight reading, I was never a good sight reader, flunk the sight reading, but still get a really good mark. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to go across the board at this level, we anticipate you need to have developed these skills sufficiently. So in level one, the two tasks are touch reading, which is our equivalent to sight reading, and that's, of course, the ability to read and apply that Braille music in the moment. And we add to that memorisation, which is essential, of course, for all Braille music users. At level two, we maintain those, those two tasks, but we also introduce Braille writing. Now, this is something quite distinct to music dictation. Braille writing is really just asking the candidate to write music that the assessor directs. We're not asking you to interpret the music, just write it down. And that really is there to acknowledge that initial cognitive load for a Braille music user who's got to shift these really embedded physical movements that I've used so far all this time for brailing letters and numbers to give them new meaning. In level three, we then shift that Braille writing and we do replace it with music dictation. So we've still got touch reading, we've still got memorization, we've got now dictation where we're asking a candidate to listen to an excerpt, identify the musical patterns that are there and notate those down. That's something that is really common and really a common activity you would find in music exams in school and outside. But what we do introduce at this level is a task called verbal description. This is a really interesting one because it's very rarely ever required from a sighted music reader. And yet particularly for students in school settings, they quite regularly need to dictate their music to someone else to write it down. So they might do the work in Braille, but they've then got to dictate it to somebody else who will write it on the page for them in their exam. That means that that student needs to have the confidence to dictate to start with. They need clarity because if they might have brailled it right, but they've said it wrong, and so the wrong answer gets written down. And they need to have a bit of an understanding of both Braille music and print music conventions. At level four, we still hang on to memorisation because, of course, that is key. We extend verbal descriptions, so it might be working through describing much bigger scores, though. It might be an SATB score, it might be an ensemble score, so you're learning to navigate through much bigger scores. But we also add a new task called demonstration. And in this task, We're asking candidates to demonstrate their knowledge and their understanding of common instrument signs and performance nuances that might be found within a short excerpt. So it's not hunt for the sign. The assessor might say, well, look, can you go to bar two and beat three? Can you demonstrate or describe to me what that sign means? Because it may be a sign that is, it's a common instrument sign, but if your instrument is a piano and you're used to really familiar with reading piano scores, you're not going to come across up bow or down bow signs. So it's about understanding some of those common ones that you might come across even in a school setting. Our ultimate level five, is designed to incorporate a wide breadth and depth of Braille music understanding. And the idea behind this is that we're thinking about what are the skills that are necessary for you to pursue career opportunities which rely in part on Braille music. So verbal description is still there, and that's expanded now to include unusual signs and the ability to navigate through even larger scores, different ranges of different types of formats. But we add to that study skills. So now in this task, a candidate will demonstrate their ability to study a Braille score. So they'll get a piece of score that they get some time to go away and have a look at and study. There will be some errors in that score, so we would anticipate that they would identify the errors, but to be able to come back and just discuss those with the assessor. So it's a discussion format, and through that we're getting a sense of communication, understanding, being able to communicate that information meaningfully. So the overriding, in terms of the assessment, the overriding question or the overriding thing that we're looking for is, did that candidate, at whatever level and in whatever task, did they demonstrate to me that they understood whatever was on that page? So they understood the music signs, but they understood the concepts, the musical concepts. Did they demonstrate it to the point where they could competently use that in a musical context? So again, it's not about getting it all 100%, because when we first read something, we're learning it anyway, but it's about knowing that they can understand it, and I know if they've got few minutes to practice this, they're going to be able then apply it in a practical setting. So I'm going to hand back to Neil, who talked to you about some of the things that are particularly unique about this award. I'll step to your right.
Thanks, Wendy. We've mentioned that it's about the Braille, it's not about performance, it's not about theory. Performance and theory are certainly covered, but only insofar as it enables us to assess how well the candidate has incorporated that knowledge and into Braille learning and into Braille music learning. So we think that's a unique feature of the Wessling Awards. Like I said earlier on, we're not trying to compete with other awards. We're not interested in that. We want to complement the other great work that's already happening. But because we've approached it from this particular perspective, we think there are things that stand out in terms of how we're doing it. A second unique value, we think, is that this award system is going to be assessed by assessors who are themselves Braille music users, instead of sighted Braille music readers. Wendy once told me that as a sighted teacher herself, she has been deeply involved, as we know, with developing work around Braille music in New Zealand for, you know, quarter of a century now, but cannot remember any of her young learners being assessed by a blind person in any facet of their life. So ensuring that assessment will be undertaken with a blind Braille music user sitting in the assessor's seat is a is a person with authority, and that will place power where it rightfully belongs and expand the horizons of many young people. You know, they'll be seeing people who are like them being assessors and having authority. A third unique value, we think, has to do with the design of the physical award. And we haven't really talked much about that, but that is something which we spent a lot of time thinking about as a group. It was determined early in the process that this award would not be one that just gets put on the shelf and then promptly forgotten about. We've all had awards like that. Well, I haven't actually had any awards, but I'm sure if I did have, they'd be on the shelf and forgotten about. It needed to reflect the significance of achieving it. That's what we felt. The time and energy that was invested in achieving it, and the skills and knowledge gained through the process of achieving it. The Westling Award is an interactive trophy that is added to at each level. It's designed, so it's a modular trophy. It's designed by blind people to feel good in the hands, to be textually stimulating and incorporate an element of motivation. So it feels good and it looks good. The Westling Award is aesthetically pleasing visually and tactually. We thought that was going to be a really important part of the award and not just something that people would, as we say, forget about. And as we say, it's modular. So you achieve level one and you get your level one award with the trophy. And when you achieve level two, you add to it. It's the same trophy, but with more added to it. And the same goes all the way through the five levels. It's a really exciting, innovative concept, and we're looking forward to seeing what the response to that's going to be. So, it is our sincere hope that young people and adults alike will take up the opportunity and the challenge to have their Braille music skills recognised formally through the Westling Award process. And in so doing, will be inspired to continue learning and using this important element of musical literacy. Thanks very much.
So we are very happy. It's early stages, so we actually don't have an award even to show you yet. We have a website that is so close.
About to go live.
Unfortunately, there's a few tweaks that need to be done in our website developers currently in Peru. So we don't have that yet either, but we just wanted to share what we've done thus far. And we're very happy if anyone has questions. No, they're all stunned and into silence.
And we'd also be happy if anyone wants to find out more. We're obviously both on email. We'll give you our email address before we stop. And we'd be happy to send you more information. And when the website goes live, which we think will be in the next couple of weeks or so, not wanting to put a hostage to fortune. but Matthew did it earlier, so I feel I can do it. We do believe it's because it is that close. We've literally found like three or four issues that will take half an hour to fix. So when that happens, we'll be happy to publicise it. We want people to go and visit it, learn more about it, and importantly, tell people about it as well.
Is this an international award then, or is it only for students in New Zealand?
Funny, we got asked that one at round table too. at this stage, it's also new, and we need to kind of trial it and see how we go and all that sort of thing. We'll kind of stay in New Zealand, keep it safe, keep ourselves secure, ensure that what we are doing is the right, you know, we're moving forward in the right way. Even the assessment process, like we already have some assessors lined up, but everything would be recorded so we can moderate that, so we can be sure that, you know, that sort of the same standards are being applied, and then that means we need a bit of training as well, so all of those kind of things. The website will have, we've got very detailed pages about what would be in each level and what the assessment would look like, and a lot more specific than what I've really just given you an overview.
Harrison Neils from Refugees on Zoom.
Neils, you can speak. Good afternoon to you. Very early in the morning here in South Africa. I'm on my way to work already, but yes, I want to know if this can be published on the ICEP Braille music list as well, please.
Let's ask Jordi.
Very happy to publicise it on the music list.
Thanks, Jordi.
Thank you very much.
Scott Erickson here. Really interesting. My question, sorry, I'll get close to the mic. My question is around how are you going to be choosing the assessors? Is it going to be, I mean, obviously, it's in process. I get that. I guess, you know, what is going to be your criteria? I mean, I think it's wonderful the assessors are going to be all blind. I think that's fantastic. And it's a great, great solution. But yeah, what's going to be your sort of, I guess, how are you going to choose your victims?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. So the criteria, again. And that's probably something we haven't spent a huge amount of time on, because we've got a very small population here in New Zealand. So initially the assessors, obviously they need to be very competent and confident Braille music users as opposed to Braille music readers. I would say I'm a not too bad a Braille music reader, but I'm a very poor Braille music user. So
I'm neither.
So at this stage, the people that have been identified are other members of this team in terms of development. So they've been involved right from day one in terms of working out what we should put in each level and what that should look like. So we've got every confidence that they, and they're people who use Braille music on a daily basis. But I think that's a really good question, Scott, and I think it's something that further, you know, moving forward would need some clarity around.
I think it's probably fair to say a lot of things will need clarity, more clarity than there currently is, just because we are learning as we go, and we are applying a new model to, fortunately, in a very small country, relatively speaking. I do think that helps us. And I'm absolutely sure that we'll be adapting things as we go and tweaking things as we go. And if and when we are able to go international, it'll be a far more robust setup than it currently needs to be and currently is.
Yeah. Robust is a good word.
Yeah.
But it is exciting, you have to agree.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. All right. Now I'm going to
just go. Oh.
Yes.
Oh,
exactly.
Hang on. All right. Gift bags.
Goodie bags.
Goodie bags.
Goodie bags.
Woohoo! Thank you.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
Goodie bags from Band Zandt. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That sounds wonderful. Gosh. Okay, Jen. You are up.
A lot of practice with the games.
I can send Jed to get you. You know.
Can't give it commands like they can.
They don't go anywhere.
No. Find the podium, jumping. Take a right around the podium.
to be difficult. In my defense, that was right. Yeah.
You write it sooner than I expected.
We're all good. Sorry, I'm going to try not to rattle that. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and good morning, evening, night to those of you who are on Zoom or the stream. I am very conscious of the fact that I am what stands between all of you and dinner, or perhaps a nap, for those of you who it may be the middle of the night, or breakfast, I don't know. So I'm going to start just by answering the question, why? And, you know, we associate this with two-year-olds, but I think we all ask why. Why is ICEB, the International Council on English Braille, talking about Braille codes in other languages, languages other than English? And why on earth is this Jen Golden person the one who is doing a paper on this? So just by way of introduction, in the last, I want to say maybe two or three years or so, something that's been coming to the attention of ICEB and likely others in the Braille world is that there are people who want to develop a Braille code. Maybe they're well-intentioned, maybe they're not. I mean, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, but they're kind of just like, oh, I'll just whip something up here. I'll just slap something together and voila, we have a Braille code. And we all know that it's not as easy as that. And so it became kind of a concern to us on the ICEB executive, and we had a conversation like, okay, what can we do about this? It's outside of our scope for sure, but we sort of came to the, I guess, consensus that maybe it would be good if we published some sort of very high level overview so that at least when people, you know, asked the internet about Braille codes, they'd find something. They'd find something to kind of maybe direct them a little bit. So that's why ICEB got involved. And another point, too, is that most, if not all of us, are in countries where there are languages other than English being used. And you know, Christo, certainly in South Africa with 11 official languages, there'd be a lot to say. You know, Canada is an officially bilingual country. You know, Irish Unified Braille, Welsh Unified Braille, and so on. And Maori, of course, in New Zealand. So there's that aspect of it as well. And as to why I'm the one that's doing this, well, one of the reasons is that I don't know if I volunteered, was voluntold, was tasked by the executive to put this document together, but I have a master's degree in linguistics, and I'm sort of dabbling in PhD land. And so it's also my educational background, and so I get to combine Braille and linguistics and Braille and languages, two things I really enjoy. So that's partially, that's kind of an explanation as to why. And my fellow Canadian delegate, Natalie Martiniello, who is, I'm going to assume, not with us right now because it's very late. It's like after midnight. She actually also encouraged me to submit a paper. So that's why I'm standing here right now. So according to the latest edition of the Ethnologue, which is a document that I think is fascinating, it's basically a everything language. So any kind of language statistic, you want to look in the Ethnologue. You'll find all kinds of, you know, fun stats. So on the day that I checked, because this it varies all the time, there were 7,168 languages in use around the world today, which is just fantastically exciting. The Duxbury Braille Translator has the capacity, and I did my best to get an accurate number, so somebody can please correct me, has the capacity to produce Braille in more than 150 of those languages, give or take. LibLouis, of course, that we're all familiar, probably mostly or all familiar with, can support roughly 100, and it's increasing all the time. And of course, there's World Braille Usage, the third edition, which provides basic information on Braille codes for 133 languages used around the world. Many have worked diligently to develop these codes and make them available in various Braille translation software and hardware. But as we know, there's still much that remains to be done. I'm just scrolling. I'm using a Braille display. I don't have an embossed copy, which would have been really the sensible thing to do. Another plug for not getting rid of hard copy altogether. But I didn't have the right size paper, actually. That was why I didn't emboss it. Anyway, moving on. So before beginning to develop a code for a given language, it's important to determine whether a code has already been approved for use in that language. Now, I understand that for a lot of people in this room, you're probably going, really, Jen? Like, you think you need to tell us that? And perhaps I don't, but you would be surprised how many times you get questions about, you know, a Braille code for whatever language because the person didn't know where to look. And the last thing we want is somebody else going out and developing another Braille code for a language where it already exists, just causing confusion. Plus, why reinvent the wheel, right? So the best place to start is, maybe not the best, but a really good place to start is World Braille Usage. This is, you know, the resource that we are all familiar with. I'm not going to spend time describing it. If you're hearing like a thing in the background, whenever I scroll to a new line on my display, the mic seems to be picking it up. So not a whole lot that I can do about that. So World Braille Usage is an option. Another thing is to go to the Braille authority in the country where the language is spoken that you're interested in developing a code for, which is an incredibly clumsy sentence grammatically, but the country's Braille authority is a good option, as well as, you know, if it's a country where there is no Braille authority, then another option would be a blindness organization, sort of a credible blindness organization in the country where, again, where the language is spoken. So there are options, you know, where people can go if they are, you know, wanting to develop a Braille code. So people often assume that knowledge of one Braille code is sufficient to develop codes for other languages. Oh, I know Braille, I can go do this, right? This is what, you know, this is a misconception that's out there, that it's simply a matter of just assigning some symbols to various dot combinations and off you go, you've got yourself a Braille code. Another concerning misconception is that Braille codes, or at least, you know, maybe just a Braille alphabet, can be generated in a matter of minutes. And as I kind of mentioned earlier, such efforts have been brought to the attention of ICEB in the last few years, which is what has prompted all of this. And what happens is, you know, kind of like our discussion with Wikipedia, where people get information from there and just, I'm like, oh yeah, this is perfect, this is great. These efforts are often praised in the media. Oh, look, this kind, charitable person has developed a code for these poor blind people. So we have to be really mindful of the kind of messaging that is, you know, put out there. And some of these codes can be developed regardless of whether or not, you know, they're robust, whether or not they've been accepted by the community that would rely on them. So in reality, the following, you know, here's some expertise, areas of expertise that are needed if you're going to develop a Braille code. So knowledge of an existing Braille code, right? It's not the only thing you need, but it's definitely something that you want to have as a part of the process. An understanding of how Braille codes are developed. It's one thing to know Braille. It's another thing to know what kinds of considerations need to be factored in to develop a Braille code. And I think I'm in the perfect place to have this conversation because anybody who's on the CMC or has been involved over the long haul with the development of UEB, I think understands what I'm talking about with this. As well, a linguistics-based perspective on language and orthography, so spoken and written language. Fluency in the language that the code will represent, imagine that. And familiarity with the print orthography already in use for that language. And just to kind of illustrate, you know, what is meant by that, there are languages that have different writing systems. In Canada, some of our Inuit languages, Inuktitut, I'll use as an example, there's a writing system that uses the Roman alphabet, and there's one that uses a syllable-based approach, a syllabary. And so you need to know which one you're developing the Braille code to work with and which one is accepted by the community. So it's absolutely critical that members of the language community, including Braille readers, are actively involved in the project. And in fact, Braille codes that have been implemented successfully are those that have been initiated by members of the community, such as, you know, speakers of the language. Well-intentioned efforts that did not begin with speakers of the language are much less likely to receive widespread acceptance because they might be perceived also as being imposed on the community from the outside. A Braille code should always be developed for readers in the community as a whole rather than a specific individual. It's very tempting if someone's in a situation where they have a student that might benefit from this code to just only think about that student, but that's not really beneficial over the long term. So just to give a bit of an overview of some additional requirements or things that need to be a part of the code, the Braille code must parallel the print orthography. And this is, you know, kind of the example that I gave with the syllabary versus the Roman alphabet. So it really does require collaboration with members of the community because they will understand the relevant cultural context as well. It's not necessarily up to the developers of a Braille code to choose one orthography over another. If there's variation in the print orthography, another aspect of this is that shouldn't be eliminated in Braille. You can't just sort of decide, oh, well, they sometimes do this and they sometimes do that, so we're going to choose this path forward. A Braille code that doesn't parallel the print orthography used by the linguistic community could put some readers at a disadvantage. Another item to consider is that it's often preferable to use one cell per phoneme. So I'm going to get a little linguistic-y here. So a phoneme, linguistics kind of, there's an approach to it where you look at language as a whole bunch of building blocks. And a phoneme is basically a sound that can be distinguished from another sound. And so sometimes it's easy to kind of confuse this. Like, I don't want to say a phoneme is not... P is not a phoneme, right? That's a letter of the alphabet, but P or T or D, these things are phonemes, they're sounds. And they're different in different languages, and there are some languages that don't have certain phonemes that other languages do have. So it's often preferable to use one cell per phoneme rather than a multi-cell symbol to represent each component. So basically where this is coming from, and this is, I meant to mention this at the beginning, when I was developing the document that's on the ICEB website that kind of, this paper incorporates some of that. I've added other things into the paper, but Dr. Robert Engelbretson was very, very instrumental. I had a lot of conversations with him, and he was really helpful in talking some of this stuff through. And this was one of the things that we talked about where in UEB, because of the way we do things, the way we accent a character, right? We take the letter, and then we have the symbol for the letter, and then we have a symbol for the kind of accent that's going on that letter. Whereas in a language where this, you know, an accented character maybe is used all the time, you don't necessarily want to take the UEB approach with that symbol. You may want to have a one-cell symbol, especially if it's really common. You want to have a one-cell symbol that represents whatever this character happens to be. So an example here is in French, where in English, if we were going to show the E acute, right, we would have the letter modifier, you know, the accent, you're going to specify which accent it is, and then you're going to have the letter itself, which is fine because E acutes aren't used all the time in English, whereas in French, they are, and so we have a one-cell symbol that will show that. So that's just a way to kind of illustrate that. If a language uses a syllabary for its print, I kind of talked about that. Again, you don't want to force it into a different kind of system just because it might be easier in the development process. In order to be considered robust, a Braille code must include an alphabet or a syllabary. So you've got to have basically the alphabet. It must be able to represent numbers, punctuation, accents if applicable, and any other symbols that are necessary in order to accurately reflect the print orthography. Where possible, use well-established symbols already used in other Braille codes to facilitate learning. A quick example of this is sort of like a lot of the accents in French and Spanish. And I know we're focusing on indigenous languages here, but just to kind of clarify it for, you know, as kind of an illustration, French and Spanish, a lot of the accented characters are very similar, or they're close enough that when you learned one, it's easy to kind of pick up the ones in a different language. So it's just, you know, just considering the context, I guess. Similarly, if members of the language community speak a second language that already has a Braille code, consider whether it's appropriate to ensure that there is consistency between the codes where this is feasible. Again, it won't always be feasible, but that's something to consider as well. It's best to develop the basic elements of the code, such as the items that I've already listed, before considering contractions. Many Braille codes do not have contractions, as we know, and in cases where there are few resources and a relatively small readership, sometimes introducing contractions can add unnecessary complications, at least in the beginning of the process. Again, it's not to say that they'll never be added. And also, introducing a system of contractions would be more likely to require the development of rules. Well, not more likely, you would. You'd need rules to govern their use, as well as training materials for readers, transcribers, and teachers. And so this could discourage easy use and implementation of the code. And so that's just, again, a consideration when you're developing a code. With regard to Braille formatting, and this is just a whole other conversation, but it's worth considering just using the formatting that is already implemented in the country. So in Canada, when, you know, languages are developed, that we would still follow the formatting that is already used in Canada. Again, it just cuts down on the learning curve. So it's kind of a recommendation. I would propose that in order for a Braille code to be considered valid, it should at minimum meet the first six requirements that I listed above, just in order to, again, be robust, and it also needs to have the buy-in of the relevant linguistic community. Ensuring this, of course, having a community involvement from the outset, and a Braille code developed by people who don't speak the language might not necessarily be as well received. And I wanted to note here, too, that from it's understandable, right, that someone would think, hey, this person's kind of, they're outside our community. And that is really important. I agree with it 100%. But I think sometimes the discussion around the ideology of it can obscure the very tangible reason why this is a problem. And is that simply, if I don't speak a language, I'm probably going to get things wrong when I try to develop a Braille code. So, yes, it's important from the ideological perspective, but ultimately, you know, we don't want to have codes developed that don't actually do what they're supposed to do. Again, quick note on approval and adoption of codes. Now, this is not to say that, you know, Braille authorities are like, yeah, this isn't, we don't speak these languages, but we have to give you approval. That's not at all what this is. It's actually what Braille authorities are doing when they adopt or endorse or approve a code. In a lot of ways, what we're doing is endorsing the process. We're saying, you know, yeah, this isn't just, you know, a teenager in their basement running algorithms on a computer, and no offense whatsoever meant to teenagers who run algorithms in their basements on their computers, but it's saying, you know, this code is valid, it's robust, it's you know, it has every chance of success, that it, you know, it was a collaborative effort, and so on. And so I'm going to kind of highlight, I guess a case study is maybe not quite the right word for this, but putting sort of what I've said into practice, I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of the Mi'kmaq Braille code. So just as by way of a bit of background, there are 13 Mi'kmaq First Nations in the Canadian province of Nova Scotia. It should be noted, and Nova Scotia, for those who don't know, is on the east coast of Canada. Neither Daphne nor I are from Nova Scotia, but it's a lovely place. It should be noted that Mi'kmaq, the word ending with a Q, refers to the people themselves or the community as a whole, whereas Mi'kmaq, ending with a W, is the term used for the language spoken by this linguistic community. So I say that because I didn't want people to think that I was making that it was a typo every time. So according to the most recent stats, the community populations, in total, 16,250 Mi'kmaq registered in Nova Scotia. So that just gives an idea of the community that's there. So some of you may be familiar with Christine Muse, who is a certified Braille transcriber from Halifax, Nova Scotia. By the way, I do have her permission to talk about her and use this in this paper. She is working with the Atlantic Provinces Special Education Authority, known as APSE. She had a student whose first language was Mi'kmaq, and so she believed it was important to provide course materials and other literature in this language. And her interest was actually quite timely because the Mi'kmaq Language Act, which recognized Mi'kmaq as the original language of Nova Scotia, was set to come into effect in October 2022. So she learned that there was no Braille code to represent Mi'kmaq, she was determined to get involved and, you know, see what she could do to help facilitate this. So I first heard of the initiative during the summer of 2021 when Dr. Robert Engelbretson he looped me into an email conversation. And I'll say he's the associate professor of linguistics at Rice University. Just note that. He put Christine in touch with me. And throughout the following year, we had conversations. She had conversations with Robert Engelbretson as well. And she was quite happy to follow the recommendations that we gave her. One of my courses, I had a professor who was also working with Indigenous communities to develop dictionaries, online dictionaries, and all sorts of other online language learning programs. And she put me in touch with Dr. Bernie Francis, who is a linguist and a native speaker of Mi'kmaq. And Christine actually independently was also able to get in touch with him. He was a co-creator of the Francis Smith print orthography, which was approved as the official orthography for Mi'kmaq by the Mi'kmaq First Nations in 1980. So he was really ideal, a really ideal person to help with this process. So once the necessary symbols had been defined and agreed upon, Christine was then put in touch with Chief Terry Paul, who was so that the code could be brought before the appropriate authorities within that community to make a decision about what they thought about the code and implementing it. So in the documentation outlining the code, Christine stated that she had kind of used the Navajo code that was developed by Carol Begay Green in the U.S. a few years earlier. That was kind of a basis for what she did. And Chief Terry Paul, in his letter confirming approval of the code by the Mi'kmaq First Nations, he stated, "Creating a Braille code that represents our language plays an important role in communication and accessibility to Mi'kmaq cultural education for future generations of Indigenous students." So once it was approved, the next step, and we were, Braille Literacy Canada was asked to basically endorse the code, and again, it was kind of done as a, yes, a robust process was followed, right? This is a code that has a chance to be really successful. It has buy-in from the community. And the Mi'kmaq community in Nova Scotia shared this with their counterparts in Maine, in the United States. And so the same process was kind of followed in the United States, where the community approved it. They were provided with an overview of the code, so that they could kind of understand what was going on. And then Banna kind of did the same thing, sort of endorsing the process. And, you know, it would be, there isn't time to talk about why would Banna and BLCE both endorse a code that's being used in North America. That's a whole other story, but just suffice it to say that, you know, when it comes to things like applying for grants, having within Canada, having a Canadian organization involved can be very helpful. There's sort of other reasons as well. Having Braille authorities sort of endorse as well ensures that the code can be documented. It's easier to, you know, bring it to the international stage. Maybe my hope is to have it included in a future edition of World Braille Usage. I might be, you know, it might be a bit of a pipe dream on my part, but it just helps with also consistency, right? It helps for people to know, yes, this is the code that has been accepted. And I'm pleased to report that the Mi'kmaq Braille code is already being implemented. Christine has completed transcriptions of some Robert Munch books that have been translated into Mi'kmaq, and this was her student's favorite author at the time, so he was pretty excited about that. In addition, there are plans to build a Mi'kmaq Cultural Center in Nova Scotia, where the signage will be in Mi'kmaq and English, and the signage, of course, will be in Braille. So just a really brief overview of the code itself. There's not a lot to say. It's pretty straightforward, but it uses uncontracted Braille, and numbers and punctuation, as well as type form indicators, things like that, use the same symbols that are found in Unified English Braille. And this makes sense because the kids that are Mi'kmaq speakers in Nova Scotia, English is the other language that they would be studying. Readers of Mi'kmaq and in the U.S. as well, that's the case. The short vowels and most consonants are also represented as they are in UEB. The apostrophe follows a vowel to show that it is lengthened. And I am not a fluent speaker of Mi'kmaq, so I can't tell you a whole lot more than what I'm telling you right now. When a lengthened vowel appears in a fully capitalized word, the dot 3 does not terminate capitals mode as it does in English because it's not functioning as an apostrophe. Dots 1, 4, 6 represents the schwa, and the 5 acute accents, and they are in, I'm not going to name the dot numbers, but they will be familiar to anyone who has studied languages such as French and Spanish. They use those symbols because they're very frequent. And so that also helps students, at least in Canada, because they probably are going to be studying, they're going to probably be studying French as well. So in conclusion, I just want to say that as language revitalization becomes more prevalent, the need to develop Braille codes, and just language revitalization is just what it sounds like for languages that are at risk of becoming extinct or just maybe are spoken in the home but don't have a lot of visibility in public or in the education system, revitalizing the language gives the language a chance to flourish, and the speakers of this language can make more use of their language. So as this becomes more prevalent, which it definitely is in Canada and I suspect in other places, the need to develop Braille codes is also increasing, and this is particularly the case with Indigenous languages, but there are many other languages, right? I mean, what, 7,168, right? There's a lot of languages that probably could use a Braille code, and many of which don't yet have an established Braille code. So we've definitely got our work cut out for us. To say that language is complicated is an understatement. And those of us in the Braille community know that a well-constructed code has complexities of its own. The development of the Mi'kmaq code and the process for its adoption demonstrate how a collaborative approach results in a robust code and ultimately benefits Braille readers, which is really what we all want. It's my hope that the development of Braille codes will become increasingly viewed as a critical component of language revitalization. With that, I guess I'll just take any questions. It doesn't really roll off the tongue the way ICEB does, the ICWB. I think people are hungry or tired. Oh, or Christo, do you have a question? South Africa.
Thank you. Yeah, the issue of minority languages is a very serious one, especially for South Africa with our 11 official languages, English being in the dominance and followed by the Afrikaans. What could be done to increase the interest of language speakers, native language speakers, to be interested in not only learning Braille, but understanding the code? And I'm raising this because in South Africa we have tried to get teachers involved and to try and stimulate their interest in learning the languages. But we are finding that most of the people are becoming very much pushing back, and they do not want to learn. And as a result, our languages, particularly the minority ones like Tshivenda and Xitsonga, are being left behind in terms of the code development.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think the challenge that we have, and I don't have the solution except that we have to just keep being, keep lobbying and keep, you know, advocating, because we're talking about Braille, which is kind of a minority thing, and then we're talking about languages that are minority languages, and so you have this combination of two, like a niche within a niche. So I think awareness, you know, making resources available, having these kinds of conversations. I mean, obviously there's, you know, government lobbying and things like that that need to happen. I think the fact that, and it's one of those things, I think that the more that we do it, the more, like in Canada, now that we have, you know, we have this one code, there were many, many other, we have something like 250 indigenous languages and dialects. And once you've, I don't want to say the more you do it, the easier it gets, because that's not true, that's not what I mean, but we have an example that we can point to and say, look, this, you know, it was done once, it can be done again, and it happened to have been a success story as well, which is great. So I think we just, I know this isn't super helpful, but I think we just have our work cut out for us.
Christo 3. Oh, got it, thanks. yes, the problem is that all our languages have grade 2 codes, but teachers just cannot be bothered to teach it to the children. So we have schools where learners are taught in their mother tongue, but they never taught the grade 2 code. But anyway, this whole subject is one of my big interests in life. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about this much more offline, Jen.
I'd love to.
Yes, but we are not keen on the one symbol cell approach at all, for a number of reasons. As Nchaveni said, the dominant language in our country is English, although it is the first language of a small minority of people in the country. In Afrikaans, for example, we have diacritics on letters. We've got acute accents, umlauts, and circumflexes on most vowels. But we use the UEB symbols for those. We developed our languages as closely as possible to UEB. And the reason for that is we would not like names like Andre or Jose or whatever to look differently in all the different languages. So we use
That does make sense.
We use the UEB symbols, especially because English is such a dominant language. The other downside of the one-cell approach is it would seriously cut down on character symbols for contractions, for example.
Can I clarify maybe? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah.
It's not to say that I totally get what you're saying. I think part of why, and that was actually something that Robert Engelbretson encouraged me to include. I I completely understand why you did what you did in South Africa, and I'm not, it wasn't kind of meant to, like, this is how you have to do it. Part of where it came from is that sometimes when you're coming from an English perspective and you're looking at another language and you're, you know, you may be in a context where it doesn't necessarily make sense to have it be exactly like UEB, because it may be something that, you know, is a completely different symbol. His point was to, you know, unless that's a conscious decision that you've made, which you guys did in South Africa, and you know, that's all, you know, works well, but that just when you're developing a code, to be sure that you're not kind of going into it with a, well, this code has to be done like UEB. I have to have like a composite symbol. You can. It's just, he kind of, his opinion was just, you know, which I thought does make sense in certain contexts, just to not necessarily assume that it always has to be that way, because that's how we do it in UEB. So it's not to say that you shouldn't ever or that you can't.
Kim Barber's on Zoom. Okay, Kim.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, I'm Kim from Australia. I just wanted to connect with you, so if we can connect online after or something. We are also going through a language revitalization with the Aboriginal members of our community here, and we have reached out to, so it has come from community, but it's going to be a very long journey for us here because of the sensitivity of actually having an oral language converted to a written language. And I think that's where a lot of Indigenous persons are at the moment, is that difficulty of actually getting it written in the first place, coming from all oral languages. So we are looking at from 35 languages that are active within New South Wales, within Australia. However, we have taken your perspective and looking at one with a group of linguistics as well. Linguists, sorry. Oh dear, that's not very good, isn't it, from that perspective? But yeah, absolutely love to connect. Very excited, and yeah, great to have your thoughts on our journey.
My thoughts.
Yeah, everyone's thoughts. I'm happy to take everyone.
Oh, I thought you said, like, great to have your sort around or something. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kim. I'll be all right. Thank you.
Hi, Brother Mike, two. Thank you. Thank you for the
presentation. I'm just wondering, are you able to share with us one major challenge which hindered progress of your work, and which strategy did you use?
I actually did not develop the code. What I'm sort of highlighting is the process that was followed, which I was kind of involved in because I was answering some questions. And then I was kind of putting together information. So I talked to people to get, basically I talked to people with expertise in the field as well, to kind of put things together so that other people would have resources that they could access. Because I think that's the part where we're at now, is that we have, I don't know if we've heard of one in the last few months, but for a while there was this whole like spate of people trying to develop codes, and it was like they were doing it totally in isolation. And so there was just a concern about getting information to them so that, or not getting it to them, but making something available so that when people go on the, you know, when people Google things, they actually come up with something that could help direct them. At the end of the paper, I did provide some resources so that people can even read up on the Navajo code that was developed in the U.S. and just get a little bit more information on on this particular issue.
Hello, this is Ivan from Spain. Thank you for showing us this kind of road, wide road to get this code. It's quite amazing. It is a process to creating those codes. I just wanted to share that the other perspective about, for example, my own language in Spanish, I value very much how UEB and give support and renders code characters which are far beyond English needs. So, for example, there is a sign for opening question mark on opening exclamation mark.
Yes, indeed.
That we in Spanish we use the same very code. So for that perspective, I find it quite useful. Even of course in UEB, there is no need for no possibility for one cell. Even if they have more cells, they do represent, and they opened a high perspective in language development. So even though, of course, it's much more useful to create one symbol, but I just wanted to share my experience, seeing that it's so useful to Spanish readers. Here, we can create one sign for open interrogation, and we should do, for example, this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dual and six.
That was great, Jen. Just wanted to flag that, you know, at the BLC symposium last year, Christine, who developed that MICMOR code, actually presented and...
Yes, we did a presentation, and actually, thanks for bringing that up. I didn't even think about it, but I believe Daphne,
yes, it is.
It's available online. If for some reason you want to hear a bunch of this again, you could go to the BLC website and find
but your
it.
Paper goes beyond the ICEB document.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was great. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody.
Kim will be in touch.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you. All right. Anyone have anything for the end of the day? So we will adjourn now, and I will see you all at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you.